Did you know this year marks 89.3 WHFR's 25th year of non-commercial independent broadcasting? And it's all thanks to you and your support. April 11th through the 17th, WHFR Radio will once again be asking for your financial support during our 2010 Radiothon Pledge Drive. Please join us for special on-air incentives, guests, and events during Pledge Drive Week, and thank you so much for your dedication to the station making waves, WHFR.FM.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Then and Now, How History Affects Current Events, one of the WHFR Forum series of locally produced talk shows every Tuesday from 1 to 2 p.m. here on WHFR Dearborn, the station making waves. Then and Now is currently presented on the fifth Tuesday of the month's Having One. And now your host, Ned Apigian.
Well, welcome to our bi-monthly, tri-monthly show. But in any event, the important thing is our topic today and our guest. I'd like to introduce Dr. Ara Sanjan, a professor of history at the University of Michigan of Dearborn. Ara, welcome.
Thanks, sir.
Let's give you some information about Ara. Ara Sanjan is an associate professor of Armenian and Middle Eastern history and the director of the Armenian Research Center at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. Born in Beirut, Lebanon, he has received his elementary school education there, of course. From 1986 to 91, he studied for his master's degree in history at Yerevan State University in Armenia. Most of his education was during Soviet period, as you can see. From 1991 to 94, he did his Ph.D. in Modern History of the Middle East at the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London in England. From 1996 to 2005, he was the chairman of the Department of Armenian Studies, History, and Political Science at the Haigazian University in Beirut. In the fall of 2003, he was the Henry S. Kazanjan Kazan Visiting Professor at the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. His research interests focus on post-World War I history of Armenia, Turkey, and the Arab states. He's the author of Turkey and Her Arab Neighbors, 1953-58, A Study in the Origins and Failure of the Baghdad Pact, 2001, as well as a monograph and a number of scholarly articles. He is currently working on a book-length project on the Armenian quest for Mountainous Karabakh under Soviet rule in Transcaucasia, 1923-87. As you can see, he is most able to talk about the subject we're going to talk about today. Our subject today is about the Armenian genocide. When it happened, why it happened, where it happened, and in order to give us some background on to that, as you remember, this program has to deal with how history affects current events. Currently, in the United States Congress, or I should say 3 weeks ago, on March 4th, the Foreign Affairs Committee of the United States House of Representatives passed a resolution for the United States of America to adopt recognition of the Armenian genocide. At present, it does not. Rather than go into the litany of countries that do. So this is a current event. If you were paying closely attention to the news, you would hear news people saying, why do we care about this? It happened 100 years ago. Who cares what happened 100 years ago, how many people died, and who did the killing, as if it was insignificant. Can you imagine if somebody said that about the Jewish Holocaust? Who cares? It had happened 65 years ago. And anyway, they got what they want. They got their state of Israel. And why do we have to hear all these movies and television shows? It never stops. The same reason. And they got what they want. The Armenians got no recognition. So what we're going to talk about is a little bit about who the Armenians are, where they came from, where they are, where they can be found. So we give some relevance that the Armenians are an ancient people from antiquity, from the time of the ancient Greeks and Romans, and there aren't too many of those people around today. And then we're going to talk about some of their contributions to world civilization and history themselves. And finally, something about the development, how Armenia is the crossroads between East and West. When the Mongols had to come into the Middle East, they came through Armenia. So it was quite a bit of a path. So we're going to give you a little background on the Armenian people. Then we're going to talk about the Armenian genocide. Why did the Turks do this genocide? We'll talk about the rise of the Ottoman Empire, the fall of the Ottoman Empire, and why the reasons were that they did this, and why, and what are the outcomes, and why were they not punished? We all have our ideas. So, Dr. Sanjian, let's begin with your point of view, is where is Armenia, its beginnings, and so on. So we'll talk about the history of that. Please. How would you like to begin?
Well, I think we have to give a few bits of information about who the Armenians and Armenia are. Of course, the country is named after the people who inhabited it. So Armenia is the area in the Middle East, north of the Middle East, south of Europe, where the Armenian people actually emerged, and they have lived there for over 25 centuries. The oldest recorded mention of the Armenians in history, which is uncontested, goes back to the 6th century BC. And we have both Persian and Greek sources attesting to the Armenians living in that area, which is today covered geographically by Turkey, the Republic of Armenia itself, also southern parts of Georgia, the eastern parts of Azerbaijan, sorry, the western parts of Azerbaijan, and also a bit of northern Iran. Persia or Iran. That area geographically is a plateau and was historically called by geographers as the Armenian Plateau, are the people who lived on that plateau.
Actually, for people that have difficulty with that, it's the area of land between the Caspian and the Black Sea, south of the Caucasus Mountains. So that's where Armenia is. It's kind of vague. But if you were ever in school and you saw these old maps, you always saw the word Armenia across that area. And that predates the presence of the influx of the Turks, which happened 1,000, 1,500 years later. So there we were with kingdoms under the Persians, what have you. Why don't you tell us something about that?
Let us give a few additional information about the Armenians themselves. They speak an Indo-European language, which is distantly related to English, English itself being also an Indo-European language.
Yes.
Among the peoples of the modern Middle East, only the Kurds and the Persians speak Indo-European languages. The others mostly speak Semitic or Turkic
languages. What's the difference between them, Doctor?
It's a difference of origin. And basically, we believe that all Indo-European languages, which are most of the languages which have been historically spoken between Iceland and northern India, plus, of course, the language of European migrants who took the languages like Spanish and English and French to the New World or to Australasia, they have a common origin. And, of course, some of the common words going back to millennia. For example, the English word for cat or cow is very similar to the way the Armenians name those animals like gov and gadu, etc. And there are dozens of these kind of words which go back to the prehistoric era, where we assume that the ancestors of the speakers of these languages lived together before dispersing around the world and also having some kind of a common language.
Is there some difference if the Kurdish, Iranian, Armenian, how about the Georgians would be an Indo-European language?
No, the Georgians do not speak an Indo-European language. The Georgians belong to what we call the Caucasian group of languages. So historically, the language itself has had different origins.
That's interesting. So linguistically, being a branch of the Indo-European tree, you would think would tie the Western world a little bit more closely to us if they cared about such things. But
well,
don't.
Not necessarily, because equally Indo-European are the languages of India, Hindi, yeah, and the main language of Pakistan, Urdu. Cultural differences that have emerged over the past few thousand years are immense, so we cannot tie everything to language. However, there is a strata which
culture,
really shows that, that basically shows that sometime in the very distant past, there was a lot of thing in common between the Proto-Englishmen, the Proto-Russians, the Proto-Armenians, right, and the Proto-Indians, if
so,
we can say.
So much for language.
Yeah.
So now, we establishment of Armenian statehood and as a political entity, I always see it as 500 BC. Beyond that, it gets a little foggy for everybody behind 500 BC. So we are an ancient peoples, recognized by Herodotus and the Greek historians, and the founding of the Armenian people, the Armenes immigrating from Thrace, northern Greece, to Anatolia. You might want to say something about that.
Well, I think there are various theories about the origins of the Armenian people, and because most of these happened in prehistoric times, they're very, very difficult to certify exactly. So I can only say that if we go back to the 5th century B.C., the 6th century BC, when the first consistent records start appearing in Greek and Persian sources about the Armenians, they talk of an identifiable group, which was at that time within the Persian Empire. However, it had its local aristocracy, its own leadership, which right, really governed as governors or minor kings subordinate to the Persian King of Kings. It is assumed that Armenia's first recorded independence in written history is the period of Alexander Great and his successors. Alexander, when attacked
went
the Persian
Armenia,
Empire, actually he a little bit bypassed Armenia, mm-hmm, and that allowed the Armenians to secede from Persian rule. But then, of course, they maintained their independence for a few centuries, fighting against Alexander's successors. And the high point, as far as political power of Armenia was concerned, was the 1st century BC.
Okay.
Then, so, on and off, various Armenian kingdoms rose and fell in that region until the 11th century, where, of course, the Armenian kingdom fell again and never to rise as an independent state up until the 20th century. Although the Armenians continued to live in that area, having their own church, their own culture, their own
under
language.
Under Turkish rule in the 11th century, the inroad of the Turks into that part of the world is around 1000 AD, right?
The first ever Turkic speaking groups appear on the borders of Armenia at the beginning of the 11th century.
Okay.
But after that, there are periods where Armenia comes under Georgian rule. Armenians welcome that because the Georgians were fellow Christians. Then there was a period of Mongol rule. The Ottomans start governing Armenia or parts of Armenia, the western parts of historic Armenia, starting from the second half of the 15th century.
Oh, not pretty late, later than I thought.
Yeah.
So, there is a story about there's in Jerusalem, one quarter of the old city is the Armenian quarter, and I wondered about that. And during Roman times, Rome occupied Armenia for a while as well, as I understand. And an Armenian legion was part of the Roman legions. There was an Armenian legion in the Roman army that at 70 AD, the war against Israel And that's why there's the Armenian Quarter in Israel, in Jerusalem, is what I
mean. Would put it slightly differently. I believe the Armenian Quarter emerged out of the 4th century AD, at least what my reading shows me, because Armenia was the first ever state on the face of the planet which made Christianity its official religion.
Right, that's an important fact that our listeners should really know. Now let's look at the clock to make sure that we can identify how much time has elapsed. We don't want you to be bored. You might have turned in and not realized. You are listening to Then and Now. Then and Now is a program primarily devoted to how history affects current events, with me, your host, Ned Apigyan, on WHFR 89.3 FM, making waves from the campus of the Henry Ford Community College here in Dearborn, Michigan. Our guest today, our host historian, usually I interview historians that because the purpose of the program is to get into the background of the current event issues, like we're going to be talking about the U.S. Resolution 252. Our guest today is Dr. Ara Sanjan, Associate Professor of Armenian and Middle Eastern History and the Director of Armenian Research Center at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. Dr. Sanjan knows what he's talking about, and we want to give you this insight. So we are a people. The Armenians are a people. They are a people who can identify themselves from at least 500 BC, from the historical records of the Persians and the ancient Greeks and the Romans, up to the current period, to the period of about 1500 BC, which is a period of almost 2,000 years of a known, identifiable people from antiquity, living whether in their own independent state or vassal states under Persia and sometimes under Rome. And then comes the influx of Mongols and then at one period Arabs, and loses their statehood in the 16th century, and survives 600 years under Turkish Ottoman rule, because we want to get to the subject of, okay, what happened in that regard? We have the influx of the Turks. Today we have a country, Turkey, and everybody thinks the Turks are indigenous people. The Turks are not an indigenous people to that part of the world. They came and conquered the indigenous people and Turkified those people. Today, if you go to Turkey and look at some of the people there, you wouldn't think you're in Sweden. Most of the people have Greek origin, Armenian origins, other than the Turkic, Mongol origins that you would think that they would look like. You would find that in the interior. But if you go in the major cities, you'd be surprised how Western they appear. So, Ara, give us some background into that area of our second point, which is the presence of the Turks into that part of the world and the subjugation of the minorities by them.
The Ottoman Empire, in its drive eastward, never established full control over the whole territory of the Armenian Highland or historic Armenia. The eastern sections of it always remained under Persian rule, and of course in the 19th century they were taken over by the Russians from the Persians. Right. However,
a little later, right?
Most of the Armenians lived under Ottoman rule, as I said, starting from the second half of the 15th century. By then, Armenian statehood had been basically lost for a few centuries, and in the meantime, the Armenian aristocratic class had also been gradually dismembered. So, essentially, when the Ottoman Empire took over the territory of what the Armenians call Western Armenia, which now corresponds to the eastern parts of Turkey, all that they found were Armenian peasants, craftsmen, whose identity was bonded together to their ties to the Armenian church. The Armenian church, being a Christian church, is also a national church which uses Armenian language in its liturgy. And because the Armenians have not been politically very powerful, it has never engaged in widespread proselytism. So it has made me mean a more defensive type of religious and cultural preservation. And within that context, the Armenians lived in the Ottoman Empire together with the other non-Muslim populations, like the Greek Christians, the Arab Christians, the Jews, and the others, as what they were seen as protected citizens. That is, they had certain rights, like, for example, practicing their own faith, leading their own communal activities, but in return, they were never allowed to participate in politics or serve in the armed forces unless they converted on an individual level. And this was, in the medieval period, perhaps an acceptable arrangement, provided the second-class citizens accepted their second-class status.
Now, however, the Turks eventually took over all of what is today the Anatolian Peninsula. Give us something about how they took over the Arab countries, North Africa, parts of Europe, how it spread throughout not only Armenia, but...
Well, the original location of the Ottoman dynasty is in what is now western part of Turkey. And we have records about them starting from the 14th century, very early 14th century, by the way. In the next 200 years, they gradually expanded, first towards southeastern Europe, what we call the Balkans, and the farthest they reached were the gates of Vienna. That was a major European city that they tried twice to take, but couldn't. But in the process, they captured Constantinople or Byzantium, which is now Istanbul,
and also 1453,
and also many of the territories of the modern-day Balkan states, like Romania, like Bulgaria, like Greece, like Serbia, like Albania, even at times parts of Hungary. Towards the Arab world, their expansion occurred in the early 16th century. And at their height of their power, the Ottomans had some kind of sovereignty over areas as far away as Tunisia, Algeria, but not Morocco. If we take the Ottoman Empire's map at its most expanded moment and superimpose it over a modern map, political map,
yes,
you will have something like 30 countries having their territory fully or partly covered by the map of the Ottoman Empire sometime in the 16th century when it was at its height.
And interestingly enough, the Turks were a minority in all this empire. They were the managers, owners of it. They were the military class that created it, but they were not the majority in the whole empire.
Numerically speaking, if we take all the inhabitants, those who speak Turkish as their mother language at home were probably a minority. However, during the ascendancy of the Ottoman Empire, it was possible for non-Turkish speaking Muslims also to be incorporated into the Ottoman ruling class, and individual Christians also, if they converted, and some were forcibly converted at a relatively young age, they could also rise to positions of power. However, those groups which preferred to maintain their original faith, and that was, of course, outside Islam, within the Ottoman Turkey, mostly Christianity, and also to a lesser extent Judaism, those people had no chance of having any political power or military participation. They mostly worked at their best as, you know, merchants, bankers, mm-hmm. and things like that.
So the way for our listeners to understand, the Ottoman Empire was a polyglot empire of many nations who were subjugated militarily by the Turks. And the most important date for us in the West to know is when they took finally Byzantium, or the Greek, the second half, the eastern half of the Roman Empire was lost 1,000 years after Rome fell in 410. In 1453, the road to the east was stopped, hence the Western powers like Portugal, Spain, and in order for them to go east anymore, that was the encouragement for them to go west. in order to find China in the Orient is because the road east was blocked from that point on. It's an interesting story about that period. Now, what Dr. Sanjan needs to clarify is the Ottoman Empire, unlike the British Empire, was hostile to its minorities. It allowed the minorities to exist. However, in its strength, at a certain time, the Ottoman Empire begins to change. It begins to lose its influence, but it's a major empire. The Russian Tsarist Empire to its north, the Persian Empire at this time is not significant, doesn't really exist, and we have the northern, the Europeans. So we have a state from what period till the middle of the 19th century when the various minorities in the Ottoman Empire begin to be affected by the 1824-1848 revolutions in Europe, where they want to have their sense of self-identity to break away. This is a story you need to elaborate on.
Ottoman territorial decline begins in the late 17th century, and it's relatively slow in the 18th century. But at that time, it did not have any component of ethnic secessionist movement. It was just huge empires, that is, the Austrian Empire, the Russian Empire, and the Ottoman Empire fighting one another over territory for strategic reasons. Things changed after the French Revolution of 1789 and the Napoleonic Wars, which basically involved the Ottoman Empire indirectly in them, in the European alliances.
When Napoleon went to Egypt, there were the Mamluks there.
Yes, and even after that, the Ottoman Empire was part of the balance of power game as the Napoleonic Wars
between the continued. Russians and the French and the English, that game.
However, another impact of the Napoleonic Wars for whole of Europe, including also some of the ethnic groups living in the Ottoman Empire, was the spread of an idea that we call today nationalism. Nationalism is the belief that, you know, those people who have a separate identity based on usually language, but also sometimes locality and religion, they form a single political unit, and the world will be a better place if each nation had its piece of real estate and governed itself on that piece of real estate.
That's the problem that gnawed at the edges of the Ottoman Empire in the mid-19th century.
And the first ever ethnic group who actually started thinking in that way and trying to secede were the Serbians. In the very beginning of the 19th century.
How about the Greeks in 1829?
The Greeks were the first one to succeed.
Right, we need to talk about that.
Actually, the Greek War of Independence, as we now call it, from 1821 to the late 1820s, succeeded because, unlike the Serbians, the Greeks received Western and Russian assistance. And finally, the Ottoman Empire had to acknowledge that Greece will be an state independent of the Ottoman Empire. That continued towards the 19th century, and by 1913, only a very small part of the European continent was under Ottoman hands. In its stead, new countries had emerged, like Romania, like Bulgaria, like Serbia, like Montenegro, like Albania, which had been earlier for centuries part of the Ottoman Empire. By that time, nationalistic tendencies had also developed among other linguistic and, you know, ethnic groups in the Ottoman Empire, including the Armenians, including the Arabs, and to a much lesser extent, but in its first steps, the Kurds as well. And these people lived not in Europe, but in the Asiatic part of the Ottoman Empire.
Now, the whole point of this program is to illustrate the fact that the reason why we're talking about what happened to Turkey, if the Armenians were living in the Ottoman Empire, there were pressures on the Ottoman Empire as it declined for this nationalistic movements. Eventually, what happens when we will get to the Armenian Genocide, as to why the Armenian Genocide, we have to remember, we have to talk about the loss of their territories in, Dr. Sanjian mentioned, the loss of their territories in Europe, we talked a little bit about, but there's more. There's the wars of 1819-12, which really was a blow to them. But then again, the loss of Libya to the Italians in 1911 or 9. And let's talk about that, because what we want to do is establish their paranoia about this nationalistic movement's start with other people taking their territories, and let's talk about the North African loss of their territories.
I think the North African loss of territories was a bit different because it did not necessarily come from local nationalism, but from imperialistic rivalries.
Right.
However, what was happening in Armenia and in the Arabic-speaking part of the Ottoman Empire
was an outside influence.
Wasn't that fully outside influence. It was also the development of the local peoples and they being affected by European ideas.
Right. That's why I keep saying the revolutions of 1848, the ideas that affected the Russian Tsarists, so Russia became a place where this infection starts going into Turkey.
Well, not only, well, that's one way, especially for the Greeks, but of course, let's say for the Armenians, the fact that in the 19th century, relatively well-off Armenians, especially those living outside historic Armenia, but in the major Ottoman cities like Istanbul and Izmir, they used to send their children to study in European universities, mostly to France. And many, of course, Muslim Turks used to do that as well. And sometimes rich Armenians used to sponsor bright school children, graduates from secondary schools, to also go and study themselves. And it so happened, at least in the 1848 French Revolution, there were many Armenian students who were studying there and who actually went and fought on the barricades because they thought that the causes of the revolutionaries were just. When they graduated and returned
to Russia, in many cases,
basically most of them to the Ottoman Empire, of course they worked as sometimes doctors or in other professions,
and
but
infected.
Also became very active in community life. They wanted to modernize the community structures, which the Ottoman Empire had permitted, and also they wanted the new personal rights that were now being acknowledged in the Western world to be applied to the Ottoman context as well.
Well, since this program is about Armenians, we don't want to stray too far from that. In the 1860s in the Ottoman Empire, we have pressures on the sultans to have reforms, Tanzimat Ner. Could you explain these pressures, where they came from, and in 1856, how the Russian-Turkish war, Crimean War, again, the Russian pressure to come to warm water, the Europeans wanting to support the Turks in the Crimean War. We have this Battle of Balaclava, famous English movies are made about it. This pressure is supporting this decline. The idea we're trying to portray here as this very large influential empire that springs on the scene begins to decline, whether it's the British that helped the Greeks liberate themselves. The question is, why this need to be liberated from this empire? This empire was particularly cruel to the non-Turks in that they treated them as second-class citizens. Could we go into some of the treatment issues that they did? For example, would you like to list them in a way so the listeners could have some understanding as to, it's not a matter they allowed us to have each one to practice their own faith and you couldn't go in the army, but you weren't left alone either.
Well, I think we have to look at it from a different angle. There were the imperial rivalries between the Russians and the Ottomans. And evidently on the battlefield, the Russians had been proving war after war that they were more efficient. And each war usually ended with the Russians taking another chunk of territory or encouraging especially Orthodox Christians, and Armenians are not among them here, but let's say the Serbians, the Romanians, the Greeks, and the others are, to secede. While these small nations wanted to secede because their leaders thought that under independence, they would be able to develop much more quickly and become more European by their standards, and they thought that the Ottoman system was actually preventing that.
The system wasn't good to them. It wasn't kind to them either. We need to illustrate that.
Now, why do we have the reform things? Because the British actually thought that if the Russians actually got more and more territory from the Ottomans, they would start even threatening the British imperial position worldwide. And that's why, in order to be able to defend the Ottoman Empire against Russian encroachment, and in order to be able to sell to their own public the idea that they're defending the Ottoman Empire, they were pushing hard so that Ottoman politicians, including the Ottoman Sultan, the head of state, that they should introduce reforms so that the British politicians could say to their own public that, you know, the Ottoman Empire is going to improve itself and we should try to help it.
So obviously the image of the Ottoman Empire, which we haven't talked about, is bad.
In 19th century Europe, it was extremely bad.
Expressions where the Turk has trodden, the grass will not grow, all these. So we haven't delved too much in that because if we're going to get to eventually the cruelty of the Turkish Ottoman Empire upon the Armenians, we're not establishing exactly how cruel they were to their minorities. But in the case of the Armenians, the distinction of the Armenians were that they occupied a space in the Ottoman Empire that the Turks considered their homeland. In other words, what happened in Algeria, that wasn't their homeland. What happened in Romania wasn't their homeland. But what was happening in Anatolia, Asia Minor property, here we have peoples, different peoples, occupying the same territory in the fear that they too may revolt and leave. So let's get into the necessity of these reforms after I take another break to identify what we're doing here so that our listeners can understand. You are listening to Then and Now, a program brought to you on the fourth Tuesday of every month from 1 to 2 p.m. as part of our weekly talk show format entitled the WHF Forum. Then and Now is a program primarily devoted to how history affects current events with your host, Ned Apigyan. Now, what are the current events? Recently, the United States Congress in its Foreign Affairs Committee took a vote to recognize the Armenian genocide in the Turkish state, where this genocide took place in 1915, objected, recalled their ambassador. It was a news event recently, very hotly discussed. And, of course, the Turks are very concerned about that. The European powers are not friendly to the Turks wanting to join the European Union, and the Turks are being told to act nicely, essentially. If you want to get into the Union, you got to change your ways. Our guest today is Dr. Ara Sanjan, Associate Professor of Armenian and Middle East History and the Director of the Armenian Research Center at the University of Michigan. So, we've given you a little bit background how the Armenian people were one of the many minorities which were subject peoples of the Ottoman Empire. And the changes of the decline of the Ottoman Empire from at least the mid of the century of the 19th century, the revolutions in Europe had an effect on many minorities who had of these Ottoman Empire citizens who were probably mostly non-Turks who went to school, were infected by these ideas of 1848. Affected the people in Tsarist Russia. Actually, the Tsars of Russia were very much concerned with these ideas of liberalization as well. So pieces of the empire gradually come away. 1909, the concern of the Arabs, and later loss of Greece and So the Turks get to be a little paranoia. The Western powers are asking them to produce some reforms, which in Turkish are Tanzimat. Can you explain, Dr. Sanjan, what are these reforms, the Tanzimats of 1860?
The Tanzimat period technically starts in 1839 and continues maybe until the early 1870s, although some people will consider the adoption of the first ever constitution in the Ottoman Empire in 1876 as its epitome.
I thought 1860 was the first one.
No, it started with 1839. That was the first decree, which then is considered to be the beginning of the Tanzimat
period. In 1860, period. It doesn't have any...
For the Armenians, it is an important moment because part of the Tanzimat reforms, the Ottoman Empire suggested that its minorities, Greeks, Armenians, and the Jews, should have internal community regulations. And the Armenians produced their version in 1860. They submitted to the Ottoman government in 1860, but it took the Ottoman government three years to revise, change, and then, of course, adopt the revised version. But the two main documents of the Tanzimat are from the year 1839, and from 1856. One of the major issues of the Tanzimat was to change the Ottoman political and social structure in such a way that there will be Muslim, non-Muslim equality, which was not there up until 1839.
So they had an interesting thing happen. You said the Constitution came in 1876. In 1876, there was another Russo-Turkish war that's after the 1856 war, of which, again, they lost territory, and demands were made that the Armenians thought they'd be liberated because the Russian army went so far into the Caucasus, from the Caucasus into Turkey proper. And these reforms were pressures based on that war, the success of that war. And then later we had the Peace Treaty of Berlin, which the Western powers made the Russians give up some of their territory. Isn't that correct?
Well, actually, the 1876 constitution was partly adopted by the Ottoman Empire as a way to not to succumb to Western dictates, to introduce regional reforms in the Christian populated parts of the Balkan Peninsula. The Ottoman argument was that why we should do reforms only in one part of the empire will give a constitution to the entire empire, and in that sense, of course, we don't need to make reforms specifically for a certain ethnic group. The Russians never bought this argument. They had their imperial designs, and the local Balkan population, especially people in Bosnia and Herzegovina and Bulgaria, did not buy into this argument. And this led to the 1877-1878 war, which was a disaster for the Ottoman Empire. The Russians defeated them, and
the English saved them again.
Because they thought that the Russians had gotten too much, and they really forced the Russians to give back some of what they had actually obtained politically. Within this context, the issue of the Armenians came also into discussion, and ultimately, what was agreed upon in what you said, the Congress of Berlin, which was an international conference, bringing together six or seven the most important European powers together for what we could call a summit meeting. And they said that the Sultan would do reforms in the areas which were inhabited by Armenians to protect the Armenians against lawlessness by local Muslim groups. And then, of course, report once every 6 months about the progress of those reforms. The Ottomans actually filed in a couple of these reports in the next year or so, but when they saw that Europe got disinterested, they stopped writing in reports.
What we haven't established is the cruelty of the Ottoman Empire and the Armenians, because we're going to culminate this, the loss, So we were at the 1876. Between that, up to 1909 and 1912 wars, again, that they lost, losing Libya to Italy and the Balkan Wars of 1812, they got pretty discouraged about what their fate was going to be as the empire keeps falling apart. What you are an expert on, what was going on with the Arabs during this period?
The Arab demands were at this stage still more limited. But essentially we see a pattern in the Ottoman Empire. The Balkan Christians, starting with the Serbians and the Greeks, and continuing with the Romanians and the Bulgarians and the others, demanded the same kind of treatment, equal treatment earlier, and that led to the gradual emergence of their independent states. Armenians had started demanding these things later than the Balkan Christians, and the Arabs had started demanding the same things slightly later than the Armenians. So essentially, looking from an empire's perspective, an Ottoman high-ranking official will say, well, I've seen this film before, you know, and probably this will also end up in Armenia breaking away and in the Arab countries breaking away. And probably this idea was a major motivating factor during the First World War, that the Ottoman Empire can solve the Armenian question, the possibility of Armenia also breaking away, by simply depopulating the region so that there will be no Armenians left to raise any political demands.
Well, we haven't gotten to that story yet. What we want to tell our audience, in 1909, we were going to have this great brotherhood. Tell us something about that. These are things that the Western powers were forcing on this declining empire.
Ottoman Empire was, of course, a traditional medieval empire. The reason it collapsed, and this is the same reason also why the Austro-Hungarian Empire collapsed, by the way, is that these multi-ethnic empires could not adjust themselves to a modern world which was based on nation-states. The model that we still have in the world,
like
largely
the British
today.
Nation-states.
Well, not only the British, but the Germans, but the Italians, and the French, etc., Spain, Russia, America, or were becoming states based on the idea that the citizens form one nation, and the language of the majority is the official language of the state, etc. And all the educational system, etc., was geared towards, you know,
well,
lifting
that true
pride.
In the Ottoman Empire, wasn't Turkish the language of the empire?
Not the Turkish spoken by the villagers, but a mixture of Turkish with high dosages of Arabic and Persian in it, largely because of Islam being the religion of the state. What was happening in the
Ottoman... There were not that many Turkish universities.
In the Ottoman Empire, the first attempt to set up a Turkish or Ottoman university goes back to the 1870s. There were many false starts.
Relatively late.
Yes. And it's only in 1900, I think, that the University of Istanbul, which still functions to date, was established.
From Roberts College?
The Istanbul University is a purely kind of a Ottoman government endeavor. Roberts College was a missionary school which over the years metamorphosed into the Bosphorus University. Today it has been nationalized. It's a Turkish university, although it still teaches in English. In that sense. In the Ottoman Empire, there were other foreign universities, most notably the two universities in Beirut, what we now call the American University of Beirut,
right.
And also what was the St. Joseph University, run by the French Jesuit monks in general.
I never heard of that.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about their cruelty. We haven't established as their paranoia, their cruelty to their minorities, which is the pressure for the minorities to be concerned about leaving the empire.
I think instead of the word cruelty, maybe the word intolerance will be a much better way.
Okay, that's a better one.
Because the Ottoman system relies on a particular interpretation of certain medieval Islamic practices, which says that non-Muslims should be tolerated.
Yes.
As long as they accept the supremacy of Muslim rule in the political field. It's a tolerance based on the idea that the Muslim is superior to the non-Muslim. In the Middle Ages, when the Europeans also used to think that Christianity was superior to Judaism, let's say, in Europe, there were no Muslims there, maybe the Muslim system was much more progressive than the Christian European system. However, in the 18th century, with the rise of secularism, liberalism, the American Bill of Rights, the French Declaration of the Citizens of the Rights of the Man, when this kind of individual rights of the citizen and the fact that your religion doesn't play any role in your rights and responsibilities as a citizen of a state, these became the major norms. The Islamic world, represented by the Ottoman Empire, could not actually catch up with this change. And this really created a problem where many Muslims resented the demands by non-Muslims for equal treatment. We know that the same thing happened in Europe, and it gave to rise into new kind of nationalistic secular anti-Semitism to replace the traditional Christian way of looking down on the Jews as, you know, followers of a false religion. In the case of the Ottoman Empire, that unhappiness, why have these non-Muslims become more assertive, led to more violence in the 19th century than was there before. Previously, when there was not much demand for equality, it was easier to govern minorities. Now that the minorities thought that they wanted to have equal rights, then of course sometimes those who had the privileges resorted to violence in order to maintain their privileges.
But the Armenians were the least violent among the subjugated people. Why is it that when we see now in 1909 the loss of Libya, 1912, 1911, the 1912 Balkan Wars, and now you see the European powers creating a commission to make sure that the Christian minorities are taken care of or better looked after. Tell us something about this commission, because when the First World War is declared and the Turks decide, well, we haven't even talked about the massacres of Adana, 1909.
Well, if we look at the history of Armenian...
What happened in 1908? I thought there was a congruent agreement that we were going to... Christians would be treated fairly. And then the 1909 Adana massacres.
Well, I think we have to go a little bit earlier to understand the full picture. Armenians start putting forward their grievances directly to the Ottoman Empire through a series of petitions. Most in the 1860s and 70s. But most of the petitions were not really answered. And in 1877, 1878, what the Armenians do is, when the war is going on with the Russians, they start lobbying so that the peace treaty after the war will include something specifically for them. And after a lot of bargaining, as I said, that particular cause of the Berlin Treaty of the reforms in Armenia came.
But I want to move forward.
Yeah,
the 1914, the commissions that the West put on them. So when the war started, the idea that the people in the West would force them have commissions to see how they're taking care of their subject people.
Yes,
we have to get to the Armenian genocide so that we can discuss what's the meaning of the resolution, which is current.
There are a couple of historical steps here until 1914. Starting from the period of 1880s, when the Ottomans start stopping reporting to the Europeans on the reforms, and the Europeans stopped caring because of other considerations, Armenian militant, what we can call guerrilla groups, started. Some of them were just simply for issues of self-defense. Others were to put some kind of pressure on the Ottoman Empire to introduce reforms. We must say that there was not much success. However, towards the beginning of the 20th century, there was also a body of opposition to the Ottoman leadership from among Turkish intellectuals and the low-ranking army officers. And in 1908, there was an agreement between Armenian revolutionaries and Turkish revolutionaries that we should bring down the Sultan and reestablish the constitution. And there was a lot of hope that with this new type of leadership and with the restoration of the constitution, things will improve. We exactly do not know today who was the cause of the 1909 Adana massacres, but it really was a cold shower for all those people who were actually wanting positive change.
But there was supposed to be some progress and promises in 1908.
Yes, there were.
We are all going to be brothers, we're going to be this, and then the shock of 1909.
Despite the shock, the major Armenian political party at the time in the Ottoman Empire still gave the Turkish ruling party, which we call the Young Turk Party, another chance.
The benefit of the doubt.
Yes, and they remained electoral allies and political allies up until the year 1912. By 1912, the Armenian side had fed up by only receiving promises and not seeing any real action on the ground. And so yet again, they resorted to an earlier tactic of lobbying the European powers to intervene.
Well, now we understand that it was decided in Saloniki, in Salonika, in northern Greece, that there was no way to cope with these pressures by the West for these commissions, and that they decided that we needed to change. We need the future of the empires to the east, pan-Turanism, that most of the people in Southern Europe and in North Africa and South, they were either Arabs, they weren't Turks, they may have been Muslims. The future of the empire had to look east. So if they're looking east, where they came from, because all the Turkic republics in Asia and Russia today, hence their problems, this new pan-Turanic view is the adoption of this idea meant that the Armenian Christians are in the way and had to be removed. This is a concept that I believe is the main issue for the Armenian genocide. Would you explain what exactly happened? What did the Turks do? Why did they do it? The war started, the Turks decided that they would join with the Germans. And now, under the cover of the war, they decided they would solve their problem with this particular minority, because we, the Armenians, occupied the same space in Anatolia. Other people didn't occupy that same space to them. That's my contention. What do you think? Tell us what happened.
Now, when we come to the history of the causes of the Armenian genocide, historians have a very major problem facing them. That is that from moment one, the Turkish leaders have said that they had not done anything of the sort Armenians claim they have done. And eventually, it's very problematic because most of the type of first-hand material that historians want in order to recreate the past are inaccessible, partly because some of them were destroyed even during the period of the First World War when the Ottoman government thought that it was going to lose the war. So well, within that context, it is sometimes still difficult to develop the step-by-step development of genocidal thought among the Turkish leadership. Yeah. However, there are a few things that we know is that, one, that they were very much upset by European intervention. And then, secondly, they were also the problem that some people started thinking among the Turks that instead of trying to maintain the empire, it was more natural for the empire to try to expand eastwards where there were Turkic speakers. And in that sense, the Armenians, if that was a real concern, the Armenians were in the wrong geographical location.
And that, unfortunately, almost brings us to the end of the program. So because of this view of pan-Turanism and because of the Armenians occupying the same space that the Turks regarded as their homeland, and because of the pressures of the Western powers asking for reforms in defense of their Christian brethren, and the war begins, and we have the story of Nazi Germany under the cover of the war, the Turks decide, plain and simply, to remove all the Armenians from historic Armenia and ship them on caravans to the deserts of Mesopotamia, essentially to die. And in the process of doing that, They emptied and murdered and pillaged all these people. Now the question remains for the resolution. Unfortunately, we just don't have enough time to go into all the details. The empire fails. It loses the war. It creates the genocide. It solves the Armenian problem. It cleanses the Armenians from historic Armenia. However, the war is over. The Allies have won. The question is not like Nazi Germany, what are we going to do about this? They have formed a Turkish government that begins trials to punish the Turkish leaders of the time. But unfortunately, the Bolshevik Revolution comes along. The Western powers turn their back on the Armenians and say, well, you know, we got a bigger fish to fry. We don't care about the Turks. We're more concerned about the Russians. And the issue, the Armenian genocide, gets lost. Its advocates in America are lost. And now the Armenians in America throughout the world have these pressures on all their governments throughout the world to have them recognize the genocide. And unfortunately, what genocide resolution 252, which is the current item in the news, this is the reason why Armenian organizations in America are trying to pressure the American government to adopt this resolution. And unfortunately, we tried to cover a lot in about 55 minutes, and it's not that easy. I'd like to thank Professor Sanjan for coming here today. And this brings our program to an end, and we hope you listen to us again on the fifth Tuesday of the next opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Then and Now, How History Affects Current Events, with your host, Ned Apigian. Then and Now is one of the WHFR Forum series of locally produced talk shows on every Tuesday from 1 to 2 p.m. Then and Now is currently presented on the fifth Tuesday of the month's Having One. You can listen to all of the Forum shows, including Then and Now, on our website, www.whfr.fm. Click on Forum and the date of the first broadcast. Again, thank you for listening to Then and Now on WHFR Dearborn, the station making waves.
Hi, this is Bill from I Fight Dragons, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn.
WHFR.FM, the station making waves. It's Tuesday, it's 2 o'clock, and you are listening to One Chord to Another. Thank you so much for joining me this afternoon. I'm your host, Jeff, and I'll be bringing you new and slightly used indie rock and pop for the next 2 hours. If you'd like to join the show and make a request, not only would I really appreciate it, I'll even try...